Hello and welcome to Photo Geek Weekly episode 9, the second episode in 2018, coinciding with CES and a lot of fun announcements that are coming up. Some basic mainstream stuff, and we're trying to stay away from those a little bit with this discussion. And to dive into the geeky topics that I could find this week, I have an equally geeky photographer who loves to chat about gear and really get under the hood of the technology that we are all playing with. And that's Doug Kay. Doug, thank you so much for being in the co-pilot seat for this episode.
To say that I'm equally as geeky as you, Don, that's quite a compliment. I would love to be as geeky as you, but I'll accept it. Thank you.
You know what? You showed me something that we'll talk about a little bit later on as a project that you're just working on, and I haven't even done that yet. So we'll keep that as suspense, but you're going to make me do that. And we'll carry that on towards the end of the episode. But what have you been up to lately, Doug?
I've been busy. It's that time of year. I'm shooting film again. Lots and lots of film. So 35mm, medium format, large format, experimenting with different stocks and developers and just having a whole lot of fun. I have this gigantic darkroom in the house. My wife refers to it as the kitchen. She's just misinformed.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know what? I do the daylight developing as well. And so it's pretty easy to just get a development tank. And pretty much up to 4x5, it's easy with, maybe about 20 to 30 minutes of spare time for all of the prep and cleanup and the development to get a couple of films developed, ready to go and ready to be scanned.
Yeah. The hard part is getting the darkroom back to be able to be usable as a kitchen. That's where all the hard work comes.
Exactly. So it's interesting that you mentioned that, though, because the previous guest host of Photo Geek Weekly for episode 8, Steve Brokaw, is also a film enthusiast and shared some of his love of the analog medium. What has driven you to explore film at this particular juncture? Is it to just play with the tech and try to figure it out, or is it somewhat therapeutic like it is for me?
Yeah, it's the latter mostly. I think, and by the way, Steve is a friend. He and I communicate on a regular basis online because we're always sharing notes about different film stocks and developers and so forth.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, I got back into it. You know, I shot film, as a kid and as an adult, shot film until 2006, 2007, something like that. For me, where I'm doing mostly street photography with it, it is the challenge. I mean, I like challenging myself. I like doing things that are difficult and going out with a rangefinder camera and a roll of 36 images is a lot harder than going out with a digital camera that autofocuses and can shoot an unlimited number of exposures. So to me, I just like the additional challenge. Also, really mastering the exposure of film, because it's so different from digital. So I really
and one emulsion to the next is going to be a different beast, right? Yeah. And so understanding the intricacies of what happens when you underexpose or overexpose and how it can be pushed or pulled in various different ways. These are not ideas or thoughts that come into the digital workflow at all, or at least not with any parallel status. Yeah. But it's interesting you mentioned rangefinders. I've got one here on my desk. It's a Leica 3F, which is a classic. I don't know if I'm ever going to get any significant use out of it because to look at the lens and say, okay, well, let's set the focus to 5 feet away and then just guess where 5 feet away is with a wide aperture, I'm never going to hit it. And yeah, you know what? Maybe there's a challenge there that I should take up, but it just seems like it is such a wild card scenario that unless I'm doing something that is fairly well measurable and contained, which street photography most certainly isn't, then I would end up with mostly blurry photographs. I don't mind using older SLRs or twin lens cameras or something like that, where you have an idea where the focus is going to fall. Even just an idea of that is going to be enough for me to jump on.
Well, some really good tricks. I mean, I have a Leica M6, so that has a good rangefinder, so I can focus very accurately with the rangefinder. It's just slow, right, to do that. But Leicas have a very interesting trick, which you don't learn until you've made a lot of mistakes with it. And that is all their lenses, if the focusing tab is straight down, your focus is at about 6 feet, no matter which lens you're using. And if you rotate it all the way to one side, of course, you get infinity. And if you go to the other side, you get the closest, which is about a meter. So it goes, you know, 2 meters straight down, 1 meter all the way to the left, and infinity all the way to the right. So if, you know, if you shoot at f/11 with a wide angle lens, you can get everything in focus.
Fair enough. I'm just doing it wrong then.
Anyway, so it's a lot of fun. And I got to say, the last comment I have on it is that shooting film and really trying to master it, and I have not mastered it, I'm a student just getting better and better. It does help your digital photography. There is no question about it because you're much more aware of what you're doing.
And it's so inexpensive to get a cheap 35 millimeter camera and a roll of film, and even, you know, investing the small amount it would cost you in a development tank and the basic developers and fixers and whatever else that you'll need, you're probably looking at sub $100.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's all available on eBay. Everything's used and cheap.
Yeah.
You know, it's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, why not? At least for the different experience. I remember the first time that I used a 4x5 camera. I've got a wonderful Arca Swiss with all the motions in the front and back. And it would take me like 45 minutes to compose a shot, and I'd still get it wrong. But the point is that I would sit and contemplate a shot for 45 minutes of a waterfall or whatever it was that I was shooting that day. And that day shooting with that one camera was not a marked success in my, like in my portfolio or my career, but I learned more on that day stepping outside of my comfort zone than I would have learned, you know, dedicating a whole month to photography I was already good at. And so seeing it from a different vantage point is absolutely worthwhile. If you're looking to learn, to realize how little you know, jump into that realm of things and just see what's there.
Yeah, I should say also that, you know, my 4x5 tank holds 4 sheets. So for me, a full day is to shoot 8 exposures. You know, shoot 8 exposures, you know, that's 4 film holders flipped, 2 batches of development. And by the time you develop them, let them dry, scan them, tweak them, the whole day is shot. So it's not a bad way to spend the day, especially in the middle of winter, unless you're shooting snowflakes.
True enough. I even tried using a pinhole 4x5 camera, shooting black and white film to create a color image by putting colored filters in front of the image before it's before I open it up to the light. And then I would get roughly the same exposure on all 3 and then bring them into color channels in Photoshop. And, the red one into the red channel, green into green, blue into blue. And it was pretty interesting. There were clouds moving by in the scene that turned into sort of a psychedelic rainbow effect, very much akin to the Harris shutter effect, for anybody familiar with that. But there's lots of experimentation. And is that an image that I would share with the world? I think I did. And I got one comment saying, oh, that's a neat trick. But hey, it's for the love of it. And that's why we are here. That's why we're passionate about photography.
And you are speaking of that, you are geekier than I am. You've just proven it.
I have my moments. Speaking of film, this kind of ties into one of our first stories here. And I want to dive into what Kodak is in the news for today, because that doesn't happen very often. And I'm confused. So Kodak announced yesterday, I believe, that they are bringing up this new licensing platform where people can license their images. And the currency for this licensing is a cryptocurrency that Kodak is calling Kodak Coin. And that confuses me even more. And further so when their stock jumped up a very considerable amount on this news. So for anybody that's not familiar with cryptocurrency, Doug, are you familiar with Bitcoin and that whole craze going on and what exactly it means?
I am aware. Exactly is a strong word. I'm aware of what it means. And I have studied it to the point that I know I don't understand it 100%.
Fair enough. Well, for anybody listening for anybody listening, there's an underlying concept for all cryptocurrencies is you have to compute something. You have to calculate hashes in the terms of Bitcoin until you find the one that hits the jackpot within one block. And so once you do, then you get however many Bitcoin that represents. Originally, it was 50 and then cut in half to 25. I don't know where it is right now. I haven't been following it that closely. And there's different computational algorithms that can be used, some more complex than others. And so basically you can use your computer power to mine a cryptocurrency. And so then you get some of this currency in your possession. And then you can spend it on things. And in the case of Bitcoin, you can't really spend it on much these days, but some people are accepting it as a formal type of currency. Kodak is proposing in this particular case that you spend your Kodak coin on images and specifically the licensing of photographs. So if you want to mine the cryptocurrency and obtain some of it that how, or buy some if people are selling it on a market once it gets established, then you will have a built-in platform to spend it. And that platform would be on the commercial licensing of photographs, which, you know, it doesn't sound as crazy as it seems if it catches on. But this seems like a really obscure niche of cryptocurrency. And there are already so many of them that don't really make any sense or will never catch on. There's hundreds of them. So what do you think Kodak is up to here, Doug?
Well, first of all, I think they've made a huge mistake because they called it Kodak coin instead of Kodak coin.
I know.
I mean, imagine if we had Kodak Chrome as the film for a number of decades. That would have been horrible. But we had Kodak Chrome, which is a nice word.
You know, fun fact, if I try to autocorrect my name, my last name, Kamarechka, in Mozilla or whatever, it always recommends Kodachrome is the replacement for my last name. So, no, I hear you. It seems really unusual that they've got the K and the C in there. And so from a branding perspective, they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot.
They're already off to a bad start. But I looked at a couple of other things that have happened recently. You know, there was a Colorado biotech company called Bioptics, and they renamed themselves Riot Blockchain. Their valuation doubled. The Long Island Iced Tea Company renamed themselves Online Blockchain, and their valuation went up by a factor of 5. So, you know, there's a craziness.
Oh, wow.
That tells you something that's bizarre. But so let me tell you what I think about this, because I spent a lot of time thinking about this even before you and I decided to do this for the show. It's weird because they've got to do a lot of things. First of all, I think they're talking about having the technology for an invisible digital watermark, similar to Digimarc, or as you did with Steve Brokaw, talking about what was it called?
The Imatag. Yeah.
Imatag. Very similar, right? So there's that part of it. I think, doesn't Kodak do that as part of this?
They mentioned something about finding your images online, but they didn't really describe as to how. You can put in your email address to get what they call a light paper. Yeah. Which I assume is similar to a white paper that just describes all of the behind the scenes stuff. And I did that yesterday, and I've gotten no response yet. Yeah. So that'll be incoming, but it's still a secret as to how they do it.
So let's assume they've got something like that. But then they want to do a web crawler to crawl the web looking for images. Well, that's a massive project. You know, Google does it already. Probably nobody does it as well as Google.
Well, and Kodak is only, at least to start for sure, is only going to be looking for the digital signature that exists on the images that are licensed through this Kodak coin system.
Yeah, so still have to go look.
They do, but it's also going to be such a small subset of the images out there. Only the stuff that you supply specifically to this that is then licensed from this platform. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be hard for them to crawl over the entire internet looking for that.
Yeah, I mean, they're creating a new marketplace. And to be successful, they have to have buyers and sellers. And they need a critical mass of both. The buyers aren't going to show up without the sellers. The sellers aren't going to show up without the buyers. That's just from a business plan perspective. That's a very, very difficult thing to do. And I don't know why, other than their brand name recognition, I don't know why Kodak would be particularly good at that. Now, they've teamed up with somebody in the UK called Wen Digital, who I'm guessing brought this technology to them to some extent. Wasn't able to learn a lot about them. But, you know, if I want to license images, first of all, why would I go to Kodak looking for the images? And once I did, wouldn't I just want to pay for them? Do I really want to get involved in Kodak coin. I mean, I what do? I convert my dollars, my Canadian dollars, my euros, whatever I have, I convert them to Kodak coins, and then I buy, and then what do I do with the change? You know?
Yeah. So in my opinion, what you said makes perfect sense. But what if you don't buy the Kodak coin? What if you mine it specifically? And so for your processing power, you get some amount of the currency that they are proposing. And then that goes to the photographers who accumulate this currency that has no real world value. Neither does Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency. It just has the value for which it is assigned by society. So if Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency can have some intangible value, it stands to reason that Kodak coin could as well. But you're dealing with a very, very small niche of the general population that could possibly be interested in cryptocurrency to begin with. And so I think that is going to make its value stay incomprehensibly low. That's not going to stop me, though, from trying to mine some Kodak coin.
Yeah, but you're gonna do it two ways. One is you can have your own computer do some mining in the background while you're sound asleep or out shooting snowflakes, right? You could do that. The other is you can rent time on Kodak's own mining machines. Right, because they're what does it say here? They're going to rent them out on a monthly basis for you to do mining, and basically they take a percentage of what you mine, and you get a percentage as well. Well, I mean, who's going to want to do that if their primary objective is to license images? It's just bizarre.
Yeah, they're trying to attack this from all possible angles, and really trying to invent an engine for a vehicle that doesn't exist. And I don't know what's going to happen with this. They've got this whole countdown 20 days and 6 hours as we're recording this, and it'll be out shortly after. So the timer will be pretty similar by the time you actually hear our words. But should this be on your radar when that counter hits zero?
I don't know. I'm really interested to hear other people and other podcasts who understand it better than you and I do, and we'll suddenly look very stupid and we'll say, oh God, we just didn't get it. But at the moment, I don't get it.
I don't get it either. And now cryptocurrency is the hot thing. Like you mentioned, companies change their name to have anything to do with this industry, and miraculously their stocks shoot up. I had no idea that was a thing. I should change the name of my company.
Let me ask you this. Do you own any Bitcoin or anything like that?
I do have some Bitcoin. I mined some early on. I have 0.07 of a Bitcoin. Okay. So that is, at one point it was worth up to around $2,000 Canadian for that amount. And, if it gets back to that, I'm going to cash out. You know, I could buy a new lens with that and I'd be happy with my investment over time. But I did that many years ago, and it was just on my regular computer processors without anything fancy, which is now an impossibility with all of the dedicated hardware specifically tailored to the algorithm that Bitcoin uses. Now, we don't know what kind of algorithm Kodacoin is going to end up using. Hopefully it's something complex that regular computer processors can work through, but you can't create dedicated hardware for, which would be a nice thing. But again, I'm trying to find value in this. I'm trying really hard, Doug. And I, even playing devil's advocate, every point that you make just shoots me down. So,
and you did call it Kodacoin instead of Kodak coin.
Yep. And I think that will stick. I'm going to just call it that from now on. All right.
Kodak. 1K is enough. That's it.
Exactly. I'll be watching this, as this unfolds, as I get more information on that. And it might be a topic that comes up again once it's got some legs or some progress. Maybe it flounders and disappears very quickly. Maybe it catches on. There's no harm in keeping an eye on it. So we will. And sure. And we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing is kind of in a different direction. We're talking about actual camera and lens technology. And so this is from Harvard University, who they've published a paper in the journal Nature Nanotechnology that basically talks about this revolutionary meta lens that can focus all visible light on one point, which, okay, sure, that's a very vague statement for some new technology that's being written about and covered by all of the photo blogs, by the way, but in such a cursory way without any real substance that I thought that we would bring that up to discuss here. Even though I don't think you have, Doug, I don't have a subscription to the journal Nature Nanotechnology, so I wasn't able to get to the meat and potatoes of the actual technology beyond the summaries and the abstracts. But what do you think about this idea of using basically little nanotubes and nanotunnels to refocus light from one point down to a very specific point on a camera sensor or some other surface?
Well, I have to admit, I don't totally understand it. So maybe you can explain it, but let's describe the problem here. The problem is that anytime you have a glass or plastic lens, you're going to get chromatic aberration. It's the property of the bent glass that different wavelengths of light are going to bend a somewhat different amount, and therefore they're not going to focus on the exact same position. And the way modern lenses solve this is they put in multiple pieces of glass or plastic, glass usually, and one piece of glass sort of corrects for the other, so that in a sense, or no, literally, I guess, that light of different wavelengths, different colors, will travel hopefully roughly the same distance and therefore take the same amount of time and so forth to get to the same spot on the film. But it's not perfect. So now, Don, now that I've explained a little bit about chromatic aberration, A, you can correct me, and B, you can tell me, how does this thing solve that problem?
And that is still a bit of a mystery to me, even though I read as much as I could on this. Everybody seems to be regurgitating the same information. But what if you could have something, let's make an analogy here that's probably not accurate, but it'll at least get the point across, using something like fiber optics, where all of the light could kind of come into a tube or a tunnel from one point and then be bent and redirected without having the wavelengths of that change out the other end. And at first, the technology, I think back a year and a half ago, that this was possible with certain wavelengths of light. And now they've I guess, renewed their research. More grant money's come in, and they now can refocus all wavelengths of light, which is, you know, a novelty at best at this point. But what that means fundamentally for me, and the image that is kind of showing a description of this, which we'll actually be using as the show cover image for this episode, seems to show these little rectangular prisms that are all sitting on the surface of this circular block, and the imaginary rays of light are now focusing straight onto the surface of, you know, what looks like a piece of rock, not even a camera sensor. So it's really obscure as to how this is functioning. But if you could imagine a series of squares or a honeycomb effect, and each one of them collects light on one side and then beams it down to a very specific point on the other side. So sort of like an actual lens that has a curved surface, but now you're taking light from one point and sending that down to another specific point, almost like it's pixelated, like the lens itself, it has some sort of pixelation to it, which then means, of course, the sensor should coexist with that same level of pixelation. So the sensor is just a smaller version of this lens, which begs the question, why is the lens not the sensor at the same time? And so this tech is really cutting edge, and they're working now on a prototype that's a centimeter in diameter. So their existing prototype must be much smaller than that, although I couldn't find any measurements for it. But that's not for our digital SLRs, but could this revolutionize the smartphone industry, where you mentioned the complexities in lenses to correct for the chromatic aberrations? And there's like oftentimes even 10 elements inside of a smartphone camera unit. And you know how small those things are. If you could simplify that equation so that maybe you need one lens, and maybe that lens is the sensor itself, if all of that can be combined and simplified, not only theoretically, of course, could you remove the issues with color fringing, especially around the edges of a frame, but it would be cheaper and simpler to produce, and thereby you could have bigger sensors and cameras that don't have a little bulge that stick out from the back of a smartphone. So there is application if this can get to a point where it can be commercialized. Right now it's theory, and it's very interesting theory. I'll see if I can dig it up. I'm just remembering now there was a lens that was shown off for astrophotography purposes that seemed to be based on similar principles as this. And I'll see if I could dig up the information on that. So it's being researched from different angles at the very least. But this comes about because of the limitations of light and traditional optics. And there's only so much you can engineer the achromatic lens elements and the asymmetrical pieces of glass that are sometimes they're glass, sometimes they're fluorite. In order to, you know, prevent these things from being an issue. And as we see, you know, the best of technology from Canon and Nikon and Sony and all of the people manufacturing lenses, they're kind of hitting a point where, yeah, maybe you can engineer a better coating. Maybe the image stabilizer is improved, but the core functionality of the lens remains the same from generation to generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen, I would have said, 5 or 8 years ago that we'd sort of hit a wall with optical quality stuff. But that isn't true. I mean, we've seen some incredible improvements in the quality of lenses just in the last few years. But there's, as you say, they're still up against physics. You can't do a lot there. Diffraction, as you and I have discussed many times, diffraction is diffraction. You're not going to solve that. But what we're seeing is, in addition to this, something like this nanotechnology, we're also seeing the growth of computational photography and what you can do by adding in computational processing. So one of the questions is, to what extent can computational things get rid of chromatic aberration? We see that in post-production, certainly. I'm sure it's there in our camera's JPEG processing. There must be attacking that. So we have if you look at the total system of optics and electronics, we have a long ways we can still go, which is very exciting to me.
It is.
I'm curious to see where this goes. I don't fully understand, your analogy of the bundle of optical fibers. So let's say you have a bundle of, a few thousand fibers. They don't have that many usually, but let's say you had that. And they were contained in a circular bundle. And you shaved off one end and you shaved off the other, and you could transmit light from one end of the bundle to the other, and you'd have essentially no chromatic problems because the distances traveled are the same for every fiber. But you still have to create an image on a planar surface in the first point. That's not a lens. That's just a mechanism for moving pixels from one end of the bundle to the other. You still have to get an image focused onto those pixels.
Exactly. Herein lies the mystery of how this technology works. And as the research develops, I'm sure we'll see it more commonly discussed, and it's not going to be behind a paywall. But you mentioned computational photography, and that could be an interesting element to this once this kind of technology matures. Because if you could detect sort of the amount of light on one end of this sort of a lens and know exactly how it's redirecting it to a companion sensor, then you might be able to infer the direction of the light that would be hitting one particular pixel. Or maybe there is some technology that could be built into the lens to infer that sort of information. Mm-hmm. And the more information you have for computational photography, the more you can do, in terms of pseudo light field tech. That's right. It's all the rage right now, where you can refocus an image after the fact, or blur the foreground and the background, and that artificial intelligence is getting smarter and smarter. Feed it with more information and you get a better result out the other side. So very interesting to see where this is going to go. I was chatting with somebody earlier, I mentioned that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when computational photography surpasses traditional photography in terms of the general pleasantry and results of the photo for the general public, for everybody. That you don't need to spend the money on an expensive lens. You just need to get a better smartphone with faster processors in it that's able to make that difference happen. The way that technology has evolved in the last few years alone, paired with the exponential growth of computational power, means we will see that. It's not an if. It will be replacing standard photography for the majority of the population. And as new technology comes up, just like this, we might see it be adopted even faster.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exciting. We're not going to get bored, Don. Not the two geeks, anyway.
Not at all. But to bring this back to a realm that we can deal with, like right now, right here in front of us, the third story that I picked up on was LG, as part of their CES announcements, has come out with two new monitors that have a slightly new technology and some interesting formats. So the first one is geared towards 4K video editors, and it is a 5K ultra wide display. It's 34 inches from corner to corner, but I don't remember seeing the aspect ratio. 21:9. That's right. So this is a very, very wide field, so that you could have the entire 4K video footage up. Well, you can still have control mechanisms on at the same time, all at native resolution. And I've been doing more and more video editing in the last little while, and a monitor like this would be interesting to me. I'm not going to replace the one that I already have, and LG has just announced one very similar to that. A 32-inch 4K display that's a more standard resolution. The 4K, was it 3840 by 2160, if memory serves. So that's the standard. And you can get smaller displays, but Doug, I want to know about what you have in front of you as a computer monitor and what you prefer to edit and view your images and video on.
Well, you're clearly a Windows user.
That is true.
Because a Mac user is totally unimpressed by this. I have a 27-inch iMac. It's a couple of years old. My screen is the same number of pixels horizontally and a third more vertically than this monitor. So I'm looking at, I'm going to have to look it up here, 5120 by 2880. This monitor is 5120 by 2160. And so I've got, although my screen is physically smaller, it's 27 inches versus 34, I have more pixels to look at than this guy does. Plus, on the other side here, I have my old Apple Cinema monitor. So I have two screens. One of them's old. I don't even know the resolution. It's probably a 23-inch monitor. And I love having two monitors. But I'll tell you, when I started to look at this, and I talk to people about monitors on a regular basis, let me ask you this. When I worry about processing my images or video, but let's talk about still images for the moment, my biggest concern is the print that I'm going to get. I mean, the only person looking at images on the monitor is me. Maybe my wife, if I want her to look over my shoulder and tell me what she thinks of something. But what I want in a monitor is obviously space, some real estate. That's nice. But I want to be able to preview the print. That's the most important thing to me. I want to be able to look at something and say, okay, I know what my print is going to look like, hit the button and have it come out of the printer. So my quality concern is printers and making monitors that look like printers, calibration and stuff.
Well, and,
so,
and that's really tricky unless you're using some sort of e-ink display, because transmitted light is not the same thing as totally reflected light. So
part of it is getting used to mentally translating the difference and anticipating what it's going to be. But anyway, back to your question. I've got a 27-inch iMac that I love. I've got another screen on the side here, which is my second display. And
I had a 30-inch display before, and it was, of course, a lesser resolution. And when I was shopping around at the time, it was really hard to find a 4K display that was 30 inches or larger. Now they're much more commonplace. I've got the Asus ProArt. They're 32-inch display. I think they've made a few of them. This is one of their more recent ones. And they claim great color accuracy, though I do calibrate it specifically as I calibrate my printers. I'm part of the X-Rite Colorati program, and so I've got a lot of their hardware that's really, really useful to close that gap, like you mentioned, Doug, to kind of visualize what that print is going to look like and to understand that if you're using a glossy paper or a matte paper, where the blacks are going to fall. And that even though it looks great on your screen, you're going to have to apply some kind of a tone curve to it that's going to make it look weird on the screen, that without the tone curve, the print will match it just fine on the display. So we have to kind of juggle all of that. But this new technology, and this is something new for the newest crop of displays, is they are now HDR compatible, which means that the gamut that they can display is even greater than in the past. And LG's promoting this tech called nano IPS technology. Now, the best displays for the prosumer market are using IPS or in-plane switching. And this nano IPS, I can't find much information on it either because it is so new. But they did say something very specifically that applying nanometer-sized particles, random pixie dust, to the screen's LED to absorb excess light wavelengths. And I'm thinking, well, that's interesting because, as I'm sure you know, as you get closer to white or closer to black, the saturation level of any color is going to drop off. Right. So if you want to have a bright but saturated color, that can be tricky. You know, when you get into the vibrant neons and things like that, because in order to get it bright, well, then you're going to have some light leaking maybe in between the pixels or somewhere nearby that is going to contaminate the saturation that you're trying to seek. So new tech in every way is expanding our horizons. Will this be mainstream? I'm not sure because Panasonic has what they call light modulating cells in some of their new displays that they're currently showing off as well. Again, the marketing people are kind of going crazy with these terms. But the fact of the matter is that we're getting closer to that that difference because if you want a saturated color in a print, it can often be more saturated than your monitor can produce, especially if you've got a printer that has, you know, 8 or 12 ink tanks. Mine currently has 12. And, you know, if you want to get a really good blue, well, you don't have to mix cyan and magenta and a bit of yellow in there to make any shade of blue that you want. There's a blue tank in the printer. For computer monitors, however, we are still limited to the R, G, and B, which is what combined to give us white and in different quantities for every color that we can see from the monitor. I think, who is it, Sharp had their Quattro displays for a while that added a yellow pixel that made absolutely no sense because none of the input material would ever have that pixel as input. So it's interesting to see where the technology is coming here. For an ultra-wide display, I mean, it might make sense for gamers or video editors, but it's wider than the aspect ratio of my camera, which is 3x2. So I don't necessarily need to have a wider display for the still side of things. But I tell you, when you go up to a 32-inch display, and it's like, it is less than a foot from my face, and I can really hone in and edit beautifully on that, and then sit back and not see any semblance of any pixels whatsoever. A bigger display will give you that advantage. And you know, I've edited on something as small as a 13-inch display. It is gruesome. It is like once you've seen what you can do with all of this screen real estate and how fast you can work, you'll never go back to something smaller. And so anybody listening that is using a MacBook or a laptop with a 15 or 17-inch display, yeah, these displays aren't cheap. They're, you know, over $1,000 for a good display. But if you can get a good 32-inch or in that same real estate size, go for it. Never look back. It is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I think for video editing, the extra wide aspect ratio can be handy because you can bring up your favorite video editor and you can basically put the tools to one side or both sides and still see an image that's almost the full height of the screen. So that's handy. For stills, not so much. But I was interested in you quickly said something that I didn't realize or hadn't thought about. When you first talked about HD displays, I'm saying back to my original point, which is, okay, unless people are going to look at your images on your screen, what's the point of that? But then you said that there are blues, for example, that your printer can reproduce that your other monitors cannot. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. And so when you've got, for example, a lot of these displays will say, okay, well, we can display 98% of the Adobe RGB color space. Well, your printer can print 100% of it. So, you know, if you edge closer and closer to that full featured display, and you've got it properly calibrated, mind you, then you will have the ability to more accurately predict what the print is going to be. And the difference is only going to be on the fringe colors, like the extremely saturated magentas and the stuff that traditionally monitors don't handle very well, but they'll get better. And I do, when I'm doing a lot of my macro photography during the summer months, I'm photographing flowers that often, you know, have the super saturated look. And that's what I'm after for those photographs. And I want to make sure that that connection is as close as possible. So yeah, there is a difference there. Of course, calibrating your monitor makes a huge difference no matter what display you're using. And I had somebody bring a laptop to me. It was just an older model HP laptop. And they said, you know, my images, the skies are coming out purple. Can you calibrate it for me? And yeah, that's a service that I offer for people that want to drop something off here. And as soon as I pulled it up and I'm looking at the like everything was horribly blue. And even after calibrating it, I mean, it was much better, but it was not what you would expect from a modern display. So yeah, there is a lot of differences in this technology that constantly improve. And as these come out in May of 2018, the 32-inch has a $1,300 US price tag. The 34-inch has a $1,500 price tag. And that's about what I paid for my monitor here, now being about 2 years old. So that price is staying about static for the higher-end displays, even though the technology behind them gets better and better.
Very good. Look forward to seeing it. When you get that monitor in your home there, I want to see it.
You know what? I could put another one up here. I could have two 32-inch displays. Yeah. You know, I might need some spousal approval for that, but consider it business research. So those are some fun stories. And I think that CES is a really big time for electronics and photography in general. And a lot of the stuff that we're seeing this year covers everything from, drones to new video formats and new cameras, of course. And we'll talk about some of that, I'm sure, in the coming weeks as more and more information comes out. But I think that's enough of that stuff for today. But I want to introduce a new segment to Photo Geek Weekly, sort of a weekly pick. I don't really have a formal name for it yet at this point, but I've been meaning to do it for a while. And Doug, you piqued my interest seriously right before we started recording with a lens that that you have and you've modified, and you were inspired to do so. So what's the story behind that?
Well, I'm not sure how I found him, but there's a fellow who has a YouTube channel called Matthew Stern, M-A-T-H-I-E-U, Stern, S-T-E-R-N. And he does stuff with weird lenses. And he had one that was sort of a bokeh challenge. And I ended up going to YouTube, to eBay and buying a Russian 37mm F2.8 lens for $45. It was sent to me from the Ukraine, took about 4 weeks to get here. And what Matthew taught me to do was, in this particular case with this particular lens, was to remove the front element of the lens, flip it over, put it back on, and you get some pretty wild effects. And maybe I'll send you a couple of images that you can post.
Oh, I'd love to. And I'd love to get the exact name of that lens, because I want to do this. I want to walk in your footsteps here. That's what I was saying. You are equally as geeky as me. I have not taken apart lenses and put them back together in a different configuration yet.
Oh, it's crazy. So this is an MIR-1B, like the Mir space station, 1B F2.8 37mm. And again, you can find them. It's really a super, super common lens. You can find them on eBay. You can find them on Etsy. They're just everywhere. And, for $47, it's a screw mount. It's a Leica M screw mount. I think it's an M. Is that what it's called?
The M42?
Yeah, M42. Yeah. It's an M42. So you get a $19 adapter and you're done for whatever
camera. Already have one.
And, you know, you need to use this with a digital camera because you need to be able to manually focus and preview the image. But the image is quite sharp in the exact center. But as you move away from center, it gets gorgeously blurry in every direction. So the sample images will give that away. But it's a lot of fun to take odd lenses and do things to them. One of my favorites is a 15-inch Aero Ektar. This is a lens from World War II that was used on a surveillance camera, aerial surveillance cameras.
Spy planes, yeah.
Yeah, and the lenses are thorium glass. You and I may have talked about this lens. I'm not sure. But there's a whole cult of people who are using the Aero Ektar 15-inch.
Well, and so we did talk about this on an upcoming episode of Inside the Lens. I think we kind of tagged that on to the end. So we'll have a discussion about that there. But, I mean, thorium is radioactive. And so
it is.
It yellows over time. But to steal your thunder from the other recording, how do you fix that?
Ultraviolet. What I did was I bought a cheap ultraviolet bulb, put it in a box right up close to the lens, and took a vacation for 2 weeks with the thing on. I came back and all the yellow was gone.
That's amazing.
Fascinating. Just fascinating. The experiment I've yet to do, though, is to see if I can fog film with the radioactivity from the lens. I have a feeling I'm going to need some very fast film in order to fog it. It's a pretty low. I think the half-life is 1 billion years or something like that.
Worth an experiment at the very least, right? I mean, that's what film photography is all about. I want to get a link to that, to this geeky artist, entrepreneur, and inventor that you've mentioned. Yep. that I think would be right up the alley of people that are listening to this podcast. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, I haven't yet had the courage to do my own experiments because I don't really know what I'm doing. But when someone says, buy this lens, take it apart, put it back together this way, that I can do.
You know, I did that originally with a Vivitar flash that I found a tutorial online to modify for ultraviolet photography. And it was an overly complex maneuver because there were some parts that don't normally like to come, to separate and come apart and be put back together appropriately. But I got it to work. And then I bought some Young Nuo flashes that take them apart, put them back together in about 5 minutes flat, and it worked perfectly fine. So one step leads to another, I'm sure. My pick is a flashlight, actually. Something that, it's the wintertime. If it's cold enough to be shooting freezing soap bubbles or anything outside, I typically use a really bright light source to illuminate, to backlight the freezing soap bubbles that I love to photograph this time of the year. So this is a Nightcore SRT7 Revenger. Again, those marketing teams going a little bit overboard. But it is a really intensely bright LED flashlight. And I'm not even going to turn it on now because it can be somewhat blinding at close distance. But it also has a red, green, and blue mode. The red is very useful if you do astrophotography and you need a little bit of red light, but that doesn't harm your night vision. So it's got a red mode that is appropriate for that. And there's actually a newer version of that when I was just looking for links, the GT version that also has an ultraviolet light source in it. And I love ultraviolet fluorescence photography, and I like to mention people ways for people to get into it and explore it in different ways. So whether you're doing freezing soap bubbles in the wintertime or you want to try and make something fluoresce and see what glows, the Nightcore SRT7 GT, of course, is the one with the ultraviolet light in there to make things even more fun and experimental for your photography. And those guys, I mean, they might cost around $100 or so, but it's money well spent. It's a great continuous light source for any kind of macro photography. When I do workshops, I loan this out to students that don't have flashes. And at close range, to do water droplet refractions, for example, this is so intense that you don't need to use instantaneous light to freeze the action. Your water droplets might evaporate more quickly, so you've got to work fast. But it's a good all-around tool. And I just use gaffer's tape to stick it on a little tabletop tripod, and it works like a charm.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Gotta try it. Gotta try it.
Gotta try it. The links will be in the show notes for this episode of Photo Geek Weekly. And so thanks to everybody that have gotten this far in the recording. Doug, I know that we've chatted many times and are connected on all of the social media places, but where can people listening to this find you and engage you in conversation?
Well, you can go to DougKaye.com, Doug, K-A-Y-E.com. You can find everything there that's horribly out of date. but you can find me in the usual places. You can find me on Facebook, Flickr, Instagram, and 500px.
Perfect. I noticed your website does not have a 500px link, but it's got a Google Plus link. So maybe that's one of those things, gosh, that should be.
That's just out of date. I haven't posted an image to Google Plus for a couple of years.
All right. You and me both have out-of-date websites, but at least Photo Geek Weekly is kept current, and you can check out the latest episodes there. As well as, Doug, we are going to, hopefully within the next week, have the episode that I recorded with you for Inside the Lens on ISO invariance, which was a really fun conversation that I think we cobbled it together pretty well about what that whole concept is about. And there's some fun example images that you've sent me that will be a part of that article as well. So Doug, thanks again for being here. And for anybody that's listening, please subscribe and continue to listen. Share the word as best you can. The more people that listen, the more successful this show will become. And looking forward to next week. So without further ado, get out and shoot. We'll be right back.